Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 43. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Before we get started, I thought I should bring attention to some urgent and depressing news. Jack Herer at the Portland, Oregon Hempstock Festival on Saturday suffered a pretty major heart attack just after he had gotten off the stage after giving a very moving speech. And today I spoke to Jack's friends and his assistant who are at the hospital with him. He is not conscious right now. He is in an induced coma, and they've got his body temperature lowered, but they do have him stabilized. I guess they had operated on him for a couple hours last night. And he is stabilized now, but they plan to start normalizing his body temperature on Tuesday. So I wish my old friend Jack well, and please send your kind words and thoughts his way. And tonight we also have a little bit of change in schedule. I had planned to have Judith Ann Brown on. And not to repeat a old theme, but what's happened is she needed to get some better equipment so that we could do the interview on Skype. Her phone connection was not sounding very well. So what we're doing this week is switching with Daniel Siebert, who is on tonight, and Judith Ann Brown, daughter of John Marco Allegro and author of John Marco Allegro, the Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls, will be on next week. And what is Salvia Divinorum? Is it only a party drug used by teenagers on idiotic YouTube videos and by radio show hosts doing stupid stunts? Or is it an ancient ritualistic plant that has been used by shamans for many generations for religious and healing purposes? Exactly what is salvia, and how does it reproduce? What are its effects, and how dangerous is it? Tonight we plunge back into the ancient ritualistic use of psychedelics and onto a little understood member of the psychedelic family, diviner's sage, Salvia Divinorum. Daniel Siebert is an independent researcher, pharmacologist, ethnobotanist, educator, and author. He has been studying Salvia Divinorum for over 20 years, and he was the first person to work on the human pharmacology of Salvinorin A and to clearly identify this compound as the psychoactive principle of the plant. He has studied Salvia Divinorum in its native habitat and has worked with it under the guidance of Mazatec shamans. His work appears in scientific journals and other publications. Mr. Siebert is the creator of the Salvia Divinorum Research and Information Center website at www.sagewisdom.org. And this was the first internet resource to focus exclusively on information about Salvia Divinorum, and it continues to be the most comprehensive. Daniel Siebert was featured on the 1998 television documentary Sacred Weeds, which aired on Channel 4 in the United Kingdom. His comments and opinions on Salvia Divinorum have appeared in USA Today, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, Newsweek, Scientific American, and many other newspapers and magazines. Similarly, he has discussed the plant on CNN, Fox News, ABC News, Nightline, the National Public Radio, NPR, and All Things Considered, and many other television and radio stations. He currently resides in Malibu, California, and is completing work on a comprehensive book about Salvia Divinorum. And this show is listener-sponsored, so if you enjoy this show, we really need your help. So if you'd like to share it with your friends and family, please donate or please help us out and support this show because Donations and sales have been so low the last few weeks. We don't even know how we're going to make it through next month and pay the bills and everything. So what I'm going to do is offer a significant discount on the Gnostic Media website for all of our books and DVDs starting on Monday, September 14th, to see if we can catch up on some bills. So starting tomorrow, I'm offering everything on the website for at least 25% off. That means that our books, the DVD, the She Who Remembers art, audio archives will all be significantly reduced. And, you know, we haven't been getting enough support for the show and what we do through the website with book orders and things like that. So basically what it comes down to is if we don't catch up and sell some books and things, probably next month, when we reach 1 year with this show, we will have to pull the plug on it. So if you need to order some gifts for the solstice or winter holidays, the Christmas celebrations, whatever you want to call them, please don't wait until the malls are full or at 7 p.m. on December 24th. You can order copies now, and you can impress your friends and family with gifts that show the very meaning behind the holidays that they're celebrating. So you know, many of us practice these celebrations every year without any ideas to where they originate. So if you'd like to show your friends and family some of the fascinating information about how shamanism and psychedelics and fertility tie into the very foundations of these religions and holidays, check it out. And if you want to order a copy of our first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, in color or black and white, or if you want a copy of the companion DVD, The Pharmacratic Inquisition, to blow your family members' minds away over the holidays, or if you want a first edition, first printing of my last book, The Holy Mushroom, that proves with primary sources that mushrooms were used in Judeo-Christianity, but you haven't ordered your copy yet, now's your chance. And since I hardly talk on the show about what's in my books, I thought I would go into that for a little bit. In Astrotheology and Shamanism, Andrew Rutaji and I go deep into the origins of Christianity and many other religions and show basically how these religions are at their core nearly identical. And we show how Christianity is based on sun, drug, and fertility worship. And we reveal the origins behind many of the holidays and the religious celebrations. We show how nearly every religion is intimately connected with not only drug use, but fertility rites too. And the book has nearly 200 images, over 500 footnotes, and includes primary citations, a large bibliography full of citations. So, you know, it's written for a good balance between the normal reader versus the academic reader. And I've got 100 copies of the black and white edition that we must sell, so I'm going to be knocking the price way down on all of this stuff tomorrow. It'll be cheaper than whatever you can get it for on Amazon, including shipping. So if you can please help us out with that, please do order a copy of that. And also my last book, The Holy Mushroom, in it I proved that mushrooms were used in Judeo-Christianity first. What I do is I analyze all of the attacks against John Allegra's work and show exactly what were the strengths and weaknesses behind these attacks, and I track down the origins of the attacks and who made each of the claims, and what show a little bit behind what their agendas were. And I also present over 37 color images, 7 black and white images, very revealing images from mostly ancient Christian texts and chapels that clearly depict the mushrooms. And finally, I reveal several ancient primary texts to triangulate in and solidify the argument. And this book has strong academic endorsement, and it earned me a permanent spot in the Purdue University archives. So this is the real deal, folks. So if you're in disbelief, read it and check it out. And you can get a heck of a deal on a first edition, first printing, and I will autograph all of these books that are going out as well. So how does all of this affect you? Basically, you know, the more you understand about the origins of your religion and other religions, the more you can understand the core facets that control nearly every aspect of our lives, and whether it's politics or you know, the way we think day to day, just everything in general, you know, if we understand the origins of the religions and what's behind them and some of the just basic themes, it brings a lot more understanding and closure to our understanding of the world around us. And maybe if people had more of an understanding of the origins of religion and what it was really originally based on, there wouldn't be so much fighting over religion. And I've got about, I think I said, about 100 copies of the black and white edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism. And I've got about 58 copies remaining of the first edition, first printing of The Holy Mushroom. So everything is going for cheaper than on Amazon price. I've got to compete with these huge corporations if we're going to survive. So basically we're putting everything up and we're going to hope that we can interest everybody in this offer and help us get through these tough times. And, you know, also I mentioned the She Who Remembers audio archives. That is a huge project that I worked on for 2.5 years to produce and release. A huge archive of underground news that Jeannie Brittingham Erstad had collected for over 12 years. And there is about 500 hours worth of audio there. It's some amazing material, folks. You've got to check this stuff out. There's some really important stuff there, historical information, you know, that basically you can't get anywhere else. She was archiving and recording some stuff that is basically gone down the memory hole. And so again, 25% off of the archives to help us pay the bills. And I've never had anyone order a set of the archives who are not completely blown away by the vast amount of information there. And it's got Terrence McKenna in there, Chris Conrad, Manly P. Hall, Dave Emery, Michael Parenti, just literally dozens and dozens of other speakers and interviews and talks and just everything you can imagine, and they're worth every penny of it. There is a ton of material there. So go to the Gnostic Media website and click on the icon at the bottom right of the front page that says SWR Archives and check them out there. You won't regret it. And I had Santos from Australia contact me this week to say that he's been listening to the archives for the last couple weeks. And he's completely blown away by them. So, Santos, thanks for contacting me and letting me know about that. I really appreciate it. And if you'd like to donate directly to Gnostic Media, please go to the Gnostic Media website and click on the button at the top left of the website. Again, we urgently need your support, and there are nearly 60,000 monthly downloads and listens now. So if 5% of you order a book or a DVD or a set of the archives or make a donation, we'll make it through this. So we really need your support, and we really can't make it without your support. And by the end of next month, there will be no more Gnostic Media podcast if we don't get your help. So please support the show and go to www.gnosticmedia.com and order a copy of the books, the DVD, the archives, or make a donation. Please don't wait for somebody else to support the show. We do need your help, and if you wait too long, we might not be here anymore. So, with that, upcoming shows. Next week, as I mentioned, will be Judith Ann Brown, author of John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and she is also John Marco Allegro's daughter, the famed Dead Sea Scrolls scholar who wrote the book, or famous book, infamous book, however you want to look at it, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And upcoming guests will also be Stephen Bauer to discuss his new book, Singing to the Plants. And Mitch Horowitz is coming on to discuss his new book, Occult America. Stephen Zarlinga from the American Monetary Institute, and I'm also still working to get a few other guests on that I've mentioned in the past. So I will keep you posted on those. And lastly, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. And if you'd like to contact me directly, contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And that's GNOSTICmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Hello, Daniel. Welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast number 43. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm still a little jet lagged from a recent trip to Denmark, but I got enough energy to do the podcast, so let's go ahead.
Well, it sounds like you were over there for what, a couple few weeks or something?
2.5 weeks. Yeah, just enough time to get used to the time zone over there and then come back and have to readjust. And, you know, it's a little rough, but I'm kind of used to it. My wife's Danish, so we go back and forth once or twice a year, and it's getting very familiar over there. It's like Denmark's becoming a second home.
Yeah, you know, I know the feeling. I used to go to Europe every year and live there for several months. So I've done the trip and experienced the jet lag and all of that many times over. Would you like to start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Let's see. I don't even know where to begin. Let's see. In terms of what's relevant to this interview, I've been studying medicinal plants my entire adult life. I've had a long, even when I was a teenager, I was avidly collecting exotic plants. And as a teenager, I began experimenting with psychedelic drugs and naturally became particularly interested in the psychedelic plants. I was also very interested in the traditional use of such plants by Native Americans, as well as other indigenous people, and began reading everything I could get my hands on. And, you know, I'm, 40, almost 48 now, so I've been actively studying these things since I was a teenager quite a while now. Over the years, I've been involved in studying different types of traditional herbal medicine, and for many years I had a medicinal plant business where I had a nursery selling live medicinal plants. I don't do that anymore except for Salvia divinorum. But in the course of doing all those things, I've, you know, educated myself pretty thoroughly about medicinal plants in general, but particularly the mind-altering plants, the psychedelic plants, are my particular area of expertise. Yeah.
It sounds like you've got some wind blowing in the background there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't hear it, but you've got sensitive headphones there.
Yeah, it's picking it up on your microphone, like a fan or something blowing past, or I don't know.
Well, let me find a more secluded. I'm sort of sitting out on my porch, but I don't feel a breeze. I'm sitting out here because I don't want to talk too loud because my baby's sleeping in the
Understood.
house, and I've got a tiny little house. Let me move over here. This might be better. Okay. Do you still hear it?
Yeah. Well, no, actually, sorry.
Okay. Well, this seems to be a pretty good spot here. Well, if it continues to be a problem, I can go inside, although...
It seems like it's good for now.
Okay.
What was your educational background? Was it your education that spawned you into it, or just
unrelated. No, I was interested in visual arts. I went to San Francisco Art Institute and in the late 70s and was studying photography and painting, but that's not what I ended up doing with my life. I was, you know, very interested in botany prior to that, but you know, at the time I thought that being interested in botany, you know, meant that if you're going to make a career, you know it would be an academic career, which is what I really wanted to do. So my interest in plants has always been just a, you know, a hobby for many years, and then, you know, like I said, I had a business selling live medicinal plants for many years, I'm forgetting what the question was here.
It was just about your educational background and what led you to it, or
my education was in visual arts. I mean, yeah. I have taken, you know, numerous courses over the years in traditional herbalism, Chinese medicine, and so forth, but mostly I'm self-educated.
All right, well, let's get to the core subject, or the core topic of this evening's discussion, which is Salvia divinorum. What started your interest in salvia, and you know, just talk about that.
Well, you know, it's my interest in salvia was piqued by taking it. I experimented with a lot of different psychedelic substances and plants since my teenage years, and in the course of educating myself about psychedelic plants, I, you know, came across mention of Salvia divinorum in various books and publications. And but back in at the time when I was first had first heard of it, it not much was known about it, and it really had this reputation of kind of a questionable psychedelic plant that, you know, some people question whether it really was a entheogen, hallucinogen, whatever you want to call it. It had this reputation for producing very weak effects that were so subtle that you had to consume the plant in complete darkness and silence, otherwise the effects would disappear. Well, we now know that that's not the case, but at the time that was kind of common knowledge. Very few people outside the Mazatec region had tried the plant, and the people who had often had disappointing results, disappointing in the sense that they just didn't get much of an effect, if anything, from it. Also, a couple of prominent chemists who, you know, were experienced with specifically psychedelic chemistry, people like, well, specifically Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD, and Alexander Shulgin, both studied Salvia divinorum and were looking for an active constituent of the plant, and neither of them were successful. And they concluded that whatever, if there was actually an active substance in the plant, that it was probably something very labile that deteriorated during the process of extraction. So, and that's what they sort of assumed was why they were coming up empty-handed. And where would you like me to go with that from there?
Well, discuss exactly what is Salvia divinorum.
Well, okay, yeah, I guess I have to kind of assume a lot of your listeners might not know, and I should speak to them rather than you, because I know, obviously, you know a fair amount about it. Salvia divinorum is a member of the mint family. It's a type of sage. Sages are in the genus Salvia. All true sages are members of the genus Salvia, which there's roughly, it's estimated there's about 900 or so species of Salvias. Salvia divinorum is the only species of Salvia known to produce a true hallucinogenic type effect. You know, there's other ones that have some kind of subtle psychoactive properties, like they might have mild sedative effects or possibly mild stimulant type effects, but definitely nothing that induces vision. Salvia divinorum is the only known vision-inducing salvia. In fact, it's the only known vision-inducing member of the mint family. But you know, when I say mint family, it's kind of misleading because mints are in the same family, and the family, the Latin name is Labiatae, or it's also sometimes referred to as Lamiaceae, depending on which botanist you ask and what method of taxonomy they prefer. But it is. I'm sorry, I'm gonna move something here. It is. Is native to Mexico, to southern part of Mexico in the state of Oaxaca. It's used traditionally by the Mazatec Indians who reside there, in specifically in the mountainous region in the northeast corner of the state of Oaxaca. A fairly isolated area, which up until fairly recent history was, you know, fairly inaccessible. Up until I think sometime in the 60s or so, there was no paved road into the region. There was a dirt road that was often, much of it often not traversable by cars. So people had to go in on horseback or walk in. So they remained isolated for a long time historically. And partly because of that, they seem to have retained a lot of their indigenous traditional healing practices using Salvia divinorum, for example, but other kinds of vision-inducing substances like the magic mushrooms and the hallucinogenic morning glory seeds, Oloviki, which is also a Morning Glory relative. They continue to use these things, whereas a lot of these things were apparently, the use was much more widespread in the past. There's evidence from the period of the Spanish conquest. Records from that time show that the use of vision-inducing mushrooms, for example, was pretty widespread in the Aztec territories. But since that time, that the use of the vision-inducing mushrooms, for example, was pretty much eliminated, partly because the Spaniards were very stern in trying to impose Catholicism and doing away with the traditional practices. So anyway, but Salvia divinorum, we don't really have a record of Salvia divinorum being used back from that time. None of the Spanish documents, chronicles from that period mention a plant that clearly corresponds with Salvia divinorum. So we really don't know, you know, how long it's been in use in Mexico. I mean, presumably it's probably was discovered long ago, maybe hundreds of years ago or whatever. But today we only know of it being used by the Mazatecs. There's a couple of mentions of, you know, plant with a similar name that was used by a couple of neighboring tribes, but there's no hard evidence that it's the same plant. So it's fairly rare plant. It's in fact in the Mazatec region, it's only known in cultivation. We don't really know of any wild populations of Salvia divinorum. So we don't even know if it's actually native to the Mazatec region. It may have been transported there at some point in the past from some other area where it was once growing wild. It's not known to grow anyplace else, but you know, it may have been in the past. A lot of Mexico is deforested and things, there's probably a lot of species that no longer occur in their wild habitat. But salvia, because it's a valuable medicinal herb, has continued to be cultivated by the Mazatecs. It's possible that it is native to the Mazatec region, but since we don't know of any really definitively wild populations of it, we just don't really know. The reason, this gets to be kind of a complicated explanation, but yes, the plant grows very well in much of the Mazatec region. And if it's planted in a suitable location, for example, in a moist ravine, a forested ravine, which is kind of its preferred habitat, it will just grow on its own. It rains a lot in the Mazatec mountains, and it will just grow and kind of spread into the surrounding area on its own. So if it goes, if a planted plot is abandoned, it will persist in an area and kind of become a naturalized plant in that area, basically becomes a feral plant. And, you know, after many years, the plant just looks like a natural plant, and it's hard to know if it's actually was deliberately planted in that location at some point in the past, or if it's truly growing wild. The reason we don't know whether those kinds of populations of the plant are truly wild is because the plant almost never produces seeds. And if the plant was producing seeds freely, then you could argue that, well, the plant's growing in this location, it appears to be wild, and it produces seeds. So, you know, chances are it was quite, you know, plausible that it is a wild plant in there. It wasn't necessarily planted there. But because it doesn't produce seeds, it casts some suspicion on whether it's actually a really wild plant. It's pretty unusual for a truly wild growing plant not to produce seeds. The reason that it doesn't produce seeds or very, very rarely produces seeds is still uncertain, but it's the most likely explanation is something called inbreeding depression, when a plant is isolated from its wild population and you just have a very, you know, narrow little gene pool. Maybe just one strain was transported from its original habitat at some point in the past. Just for example, for argument's sake, if something like that happened and the plant was brought to the Mazatec region, you have this limited genetic diversity. The plant's been was basically just is breeding back against itself And it causes a condition that often happens in that situation called inbreeding depression, where the plant will lose its ability to produce sexually. So that's one reason why, and also because those populations are not common. The plant is very it's very rare in the Mazatec region. It's not something you stumble upon. Usually, it's always grown in a shaman's garden, or you know, sometimes they'll plant it in a remote ravine that they tend the plant. And actually, often they deliberately plant it in out of the way locations, because they believe that passerbys who don't have the right intention or good energy, so to speak, can actually rob the plant of vitality, just like a person who glances at the plant could potentially rob the plant of energy, or possibly even transfer some kind of negative stuff to the plant. That's what they believe anyway. So they'll often plant it in remote locations, just so that it will be sort of protected from that kind of thing. I don't know. Do you want more detail?
You mentioned earlier about salvia being a real entheogen, and Hoffman and Shulgin not knowing, not being able to isolate any constituents from it.
Right.
You know, people write me asking if salvia is a real entheogen or if it's just a party drug. How do you answer those types of questions?
Well, you've kind of got two questions there. You're asking about Shulgin and Hoffman not being able to isolate anything. Well, it turns out, knowing what we know now, that the reason that they were unsuccessful, their approach was, you know, a sensible one, which was they were making various extracts. I mean, they did some basic things like testing for alkaloids, which, you know, is kind of a first step thing you would do, looking for an active constituent in a plant drug. And salvia divinorum doesn't, the active constituent is not an alkaloid, so they obviously didn't find any. But they also separated the plant, well, they produced extracts and separated the extracts into various fractions, and then tested them on themselves. They both took this approach. They just, you know, extracted it, separated fractions, and then consumed those extracts, and nothing happened. And after, you know, trying several different approaches and not getting any results, you know, at one point, I know Hoffman, originally he brought back I should go back a little bit. He made an expedition to the Mazatec region together with Gordon Wasson in 1962 and collected fresh leaves and preserved them in jugs of alcohol, and brought that material back with him. Some was whole leaves, and some was crushed. Some was basically leaf juice that they produced during the trip. They had the Mazatecs crush some leaves and squeeze the juice out, and then they brought that back preserved with alcohol. But when he brought this back to his lab at Sandoz in Switzerland, the first thing he did was try those things. Nothing happened. And then after not getting any success with that, he managed to get a live plant sent to him from Mexico, and he grew this in a greenhouse in Switzerland at Sandoz. And once he had enough material, he experimented with the fresh leaves. He did that because he thought, well, maybe the active constituent is not preserved well, you know, the alcohol, and it needs to be taken fresh. But even when he did that, he wasn't getting any results. So, you know, after a certain amount of effort, he just, you know, decided it wasn't worth pursuing any further. The same thing basically was what happened with Alexander Shulgin. But what we know now is that salvin RNA, the active constituent, is not well assimilated through the gastrointestinal system. Once you swallow it, it's unlikely to produce any effect. And some people claim that by swallowing large amounts of leaf juice that they get some effect that way. But typically, if it's just swallowed, people don't experience anything. It turns out that if you hold the leaf juices or just chew the leaves for an extended period of time, that Salvin RNA will absorb through the oral mucosa in the mouth cavity, and enough will get into the bloodstream to produce an effect. So absorbing it through the oral mucosa allows the compound to get into the bloodstream intact, but once it's swallowed, it's probably deactivated by enzymes in the digestive tract or possibly during first-pass metabolism by the liver. It's more complicated. There's something called, I forget what it's called, PDP, I think it's called. It's a compound in the gut that is an active transporter that may actually actively prevent it from passing through the intestines. We don't know for sure, exactly which of those mechanisms is at play, but we do know that salvia doesn't really work. Certainly in most cases, it doesn't seem to work when it's just swallowed. And this is what Hoffman and Shulgin were doing, is they were swallowing these extracts. And so that's why they weren't getting an effect. And the reason, nowadays a lot of people in the West, the Mazateks never do this, but a lot of people in the West smoke salvia. And, back in the time when they were investigating the plant, they did not smoke it, presumably because the plant is always traditionally taken orally, for one thing, but also they were informed that the plant has to be used fresh. This was information from some of the Mazatec informants that Gordon Wasson interviewed. They said that the plant can't be used dry, that it had to be used fresh. So obviously if you're going to smoke something, you would have to dry it first. So it was a long time before people started experimenting with smoking it. And I think, some people were sort of surprised that it actually worked that way. It turned out the information that was put out by some of those early Mazatec informants wasn't accurate. It's not true. It does work when dry.
How are the Mazatecs using the salvia, orally, but in what ways specifically do we know?
There's two ways that they typically ingest it. I don't want to forget to come back to your other question about it being a recreational versus a true entheogen or whatever.
Right.
But they typically either just chew. Well, the preferred method is just chewing the leaves. That is what most of them say works best, and it is what works best when you're taking the leaves orally. They'll just take a pile of leaves, and the dose really varies depending on the size of the leaves and what exactly the person they're giving it to and so forth, but typically one of the numbers that you hear a lot is 26 leaves. That's because it's basically 13 pairs of leaves, and the reason that number is commonly used is because pairs have a special magical significance to them, presumably because it represents male and female. And the number 13 also has some special cosmological significance to them. So 13 pairs is a special number for them, and it happens to be a pretty good dose in most cases for chewing the salvia leaves. But they're not, that's not rigid. Sometimes they'll take 6 or 8 leaves, or sometimes they'll take 200. It really varies a lot. Partly because the leaves vary a lot in size, for one thing, but also presumably because sometimes they want a stronger effect or a weaker effect. So just chewing the leaves, they'll make a bundle. Sometimes they'll roll it in a little cylinder so you can just sort of chomp away on it. It's like a cigar-shaped cylinder. And just take a mouthful and chew it up and chew it well and swallow that mouthful and take another mouthful and work your way to get to the end of it. With a bundle of like 26 large leaves, it can take a good 15 or 20 minutes to get through that pile of leaves. And so basically your mouth cavity is being coated with this leaf juice during that entire period, which that allows sufficient time for you to get enough into the bloodstream to produce an effect. If you take that same 26 leaves and, for example, grind it up in a blender with some water and make a slurry so that it can be gulped down quickly, it doesn't produce an effect. Gulping that same amount down quickly doesn't produce an effect, but obviously that's not what the Mazatecs do. But there is another approach that the Mazatecs sometimes use, where they'll crush the leaves up, usually on a stone grinding instrument called a matate. They'll crush the leaves up and the pulp, and then they'll squeeze that pulp to extract the leaf juices and mix that juice with some water and then drink that. And that tends to produce a much milder effect, presumably because the leaf, the mouth cavity is not, you know, staying in contact with the leaf juices as long as that it would be when the leaves are being chewed directly. But those are the two ways they take it, and they always take it in a very highly ceremonial manner. It's a very serious affair, taking celery. They don't you know, do it lightly. They always do it when there's a serious issue at hand that needs to be dealt with. And for them, it's they use it to consult with the supernatural world, and so they'll, you know, when there's a client, you know, if a shaman has a patient or client, whatever term you want to use, who's having some kind of problems, health problems or other issues in life that are thought to have some kind of supernatural cause, they'll take salvia, or sometimes they'll use mushrooms and other things. Tobacco also, you know, I should mention, is part of their kind of ritual sacred plants that they use. In fact, tobacco always accompanies their, you know, all those sessions, whether it's mushrooms or salvia. Tobacco is part of it, although I should point out that they don't usually smoke it, although sometimes they do make homemade cigars out of tobacco. The primary way it's used is they make a paste from the fresh tobacco leaves. They'll grind up the fresh tobacco leaves with lime, not the fruit, but the, you know, lime from limestone. And sometimes I'll add a little garlic to that, and that seems to be not too often the case. But they'll make this paste, and it's called pisiete, and that's has some, you know, it's considered to have a high spiritual value and have protective powers and so forth. And they'll rub that on certain parts of the body during the session. They'll rub it on the wrists and the forehead and things like this. And sometimes they'll rub it on the gums, and obviously rubbing it on the gums actually tends to produce an effect similar to chewing tobacco. It's not really a psychedelic effect, but it definitely has an effect that adds to the experience. But primarily, I think the main reason it's incorporated in sessions with other vision-inducing substances is for protective power. It's considered, you rubbing on certain parts of the body, it protects you from bad spirits and things like that. I should go back a little ways in terms of how they use it. They use it in a very sincere way. The sessions that they do are primarily filled with religious chanting and prayer. They're very prayerful sessions. They don't sit around in silence very much. They, you know, sort of like I might do, sit around in silence a lot, sort of delving into my inner psyche. They spend this experience praying for aid for the problem at hand and asking, often verbally, for vision. They associate Salvia Divinorum with the Virgin Mary. In fact, they really kind of consider it an incarnation of the Virgin Mary, or you know, what they call the Virgin Mary now, but their idea of the Virgin Mary seems to be blended with some pre-Christian goddess figure.
Also relate it to another name was Virginia de la Pastora or something like that?
Well, they have several names like that. Yerba de Pastora, Herb of the Virgin. The Virgin that they're talking about is the Virgin Mary. Mary's herb.
Let's go back and let's hit that one question, and you know, about salvia being a real entheogen versus party drug. And
yeah, well, entheogens is kind of a tricky word, but unfortunately there's no perfect word to describe these kinds of substances.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. You know, I've had Carl Ruck on my show twice, and I've been to his place, and he's a pretty adamant atheist, and he's the one who created the word.
I didn't know that about him. That's funny.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with a God connotation, because he's talking about developing your God within, but not like a general theological sense of God.
Right.
But go ahead.
Yeah. Although it's tricky because the word Theo means God. But I see. You know,
Exactly.
It's interesting to know that. Anyway, whatever you want to call these things, it's definitely a true hallucinogen, at least to my interpretation of that word. You know, to sufficiently high doses, salvia produces an intense visionary experience where you see things that aren't ordinarily there. It also puts you in touch with some aspects of your inner psyche, you know, subconscious parts of your mind that you ordinarily don't have access to. Yeah.
Let's talk more about the experience of it a little later on.
Yeah. Well, my point is about mentioning those things is that, yes, it is a true hallucinogen, entheogen. It definitely belongs in that category of things, along with psilocybin and LSD, so forth. So in every respect, that it belongs in that category. How people use it is another matter. People use all these things in various ways. Some people, as I mentioned, the Mazatecs, are, for example, use these things as sacraments. And, you know, a lot of people, young people, especially in the West these days, kind of just fool around and, you know, want to have an unusual experience, and they're not really using it in a very mindful manner. So, you know, it can be both. It can be whatever you make it. Although it's not really very suitable for kind of party use. It doesn't produce very, you know, fun effects. It tends to put people in this very internal, inner space where they lose touch with their environment and people around. And so taking it in a social situation doesn't really make much sense, because you just go into this internal space. And if you try to continue to interact with your environment, it becomes difficult and confusing and disorientating. And you have to kind of struggle against the effect to try and stay in touch with the outside world. And it's really, you're basically fighting the experience. So, you know, the nature of the plant is not really, you know, recreational type of substance.
Right.
The effect doesn't suit it.
Which is ironic, because it's all of the kids out there misusing it that seem to be leading toward its it toward its outlaw. But
which has been the case with a number of other substances in the past. It's kind of predictable,
right,
that it's going that course.
Yeah, that's true. Who first discovered salvia, at least as far as Western culture? Was it Wasson, or was it Hoffman or Schultes?
Well, no, it wasn't Schultes, although Schultes had done field work in the Mazatec region, I think in the 40s when he was working on his PhD dissertation. But he didn't come across salvia ignorum, surprisingly, although he studied a lot of the plants as they used traditionally. Well, the first mention of a plant that is almost certainly Salvia divinorum comes from the 50s. I think it's 52, if I remember correctly. But the plant wasn't collected. It wasn't identified. It was just an anthropologist who was working amongst the Mazatecs, you know, wrote about this plant. And it had the name, I forget exactly which name he referred to, but it was one of the names that basically is like plant herb of the virgin, that kind of thing. And the description of the effects matches it, so it's pretty sure he was talking about the same thing. But it wasn't until I think 1958 that the plant was actually collected. An herbarium specimen was collected by Arturo Gomez Pompa, a Mexican ethnobotanist who was working for Ceiba Pharmaceuticals at the time. And he was sent to the Mazatec region to collect medicinal plants. I think he was specifically collecting the mushrooms at the time, because there was a lot of excitement about these newly discovered or newly rediscovered vision-inducing mushrooms that they use. And while he was there, a shaman told him about this other plant that they use in a similar manner, and he collected some specimens and but wasn't able to identify the plant, because while he was in the region, it wasn't the flowering season for the plant. Some of the specimens had buds just sort of beginning to develop, but because they weren't fully developed flowers, he wasn't able to correctly identify the plant. And it wasn't until 1962 that specimens suitable for identification were collected by Gordon Wasson. And he had collected several specimens in the early 60s, like 60, 61, and 62. The first few specimens he collected also weren't suitable for identification because they either didn't have fully developed flowers or because by the time they made them back to the United States, they had gotten all moldy. So he had a few disappointing attempts at trying to get the plant identified. In 1962, during an expedition he made together with Albert Hoffman, they collected some very good specimens. And he, as soon as he got back to the United States, he quickly sent them to Carl Epling, expert in the New World salvias, who was at UCLA at the time. And Epling declared that this was a species new to science and named it Salvia divinorum after the traditional use as a sort of aid to divination. And that's the story of the discovery of the plant. So it was 1962 that it was really identified botanically.
Now, is all of the salvia that is out there and available today, is that all from one original source, from one original plant?
Well, that's a pretty good question. Well, we don't really know. It's a question about how far you go back, and we don't know if the plants in the Mazatec region, you know, how we don't know how much genetic diversity there is there, because the plants, like I said, almost never produce seed. I mean, there's a few cases where seeds have been reported from the plant, but given how many people have tried growing it and farmed it over the years, I only know of, you know, just, you know, 5 or 6 cases of people getting some seed on the plants. Because it so seldom produces seeds, it's almost always propagated from asexually from cuttings, which is the normal Mazatec practice. So it may be that most of the plants in the Mazatec region all belong to, you know, just one or a few strains, genetically different strains. If it was brought to the Mazatec region, you know, some point in the past from some other area, maybe hundreds of years ago, you know, it might be that just one cutting was brought to the region, grown because it was a useful medicinal plant. So the genetic diversity might be very restricted. But if my point is that if it was brought back to the Mazatec region from some other area in the past, it might be that basically that is one strain, in which case, you know, most of what people are growing that's been collected in the Mazatec region is also one strain or possibly 2 or 3 or whatever. We don't really know yet how much diversity there is just in the Mazatec region to begin with. But there have been several collections made of live material from the Mazatec region. Whether or not they're different is the question. All the collections, plants collected from the Mazatec region, are visually identical. I haven't been able to see any difference between any of them. To answer your question a little further, the first Lya material was collected in late 1962 by Sterling Bunnell, a psychiatrist in the Bay Area who's doing some research on magic mushrooms in the Mazatec region, almost concurrently with Wasson's expedition in 1962, just a month or two later. But he brought some live plant material back to Berkeley, where he was living at the time, and got it back alive. And he gave some of that material to Alexander Shulgin. And also he gave some to Carl Epling at UCLA, of these live plants that he brought back. So it was cultivated by them. And over the years, it was cuttings of those plants were circulated to other people. And I think it was in the early 70s, it started becoming available through like one specialty plant nursery, a mail order plant nursery. And then for years that was the case. All the plant material that was available in the United States was derived from that material that Sterling Bunnell had brought back. And for many years it stayed that way. It wasn't until I think the early 80s that someone brought back another strain from the monolithic region, at least that we know about, another live strain. But during that gap between 1962 and the early 80s, it spread around a fair amount, and I think that most of the material growing outside of the monolithic region today still is probably that's derived from that one original strain, although there are some others in circulation too.
Well, you mentioned the use of salvia in Mazatec culture. What was the role of salvia, and what were its traditional uses? Was it just for healing, or can you talk a little bit more about that? Do you know more about that?
Yeah, I think I do. It's traditionally used for, well, I touched on this before, it's traditionally used to contact the supernatural world, and that's something that's done to gain assistance with a problem of some kind. So it's not necessarily healing on physical healing, although that is a very common use. Mazatec people are, I use the word superstitious, but a lot of people might not like to use that term. They believe that a lot of illnesses and other bad things that happen to people in life are the result of some supernatural, something happening in the supernatural world. For example, if you fail to, appease the local spirits that reside, in the hillside where you grow your crops, don't leave the appropriate offerings or something, they might get angry and make you sick. Or you might have an envious neighbor who doesn't like you and puts some kind of curse on you. And so they believe in this kind of thing. And so when bad things happen, they often think, well, this is caused by something, is going on in the supernatural realm. And so they'll consult with the shaman whose expertise is in sort of acting as an intermediary with supernatural beings. And they'll take plants like Salvia divinorum to have access to the supernatural world. And so when they have a visionary experience, they believe that they are actually entering into this supernatural realm where they can specifically, actually contact these entities and ask for assistance. Typically, they, like I mentioned, the Virgin Mary will petition the Virgin Mary to come to their aid, to heal them. Or it's not necessarily just healing. Sometimes people, maybe they're crops are dying from disease, or maybe it's been a drought that year, or their animals are sick, or maybe their marriage is falling apart, or it can be all kinds of reasons. But when things are not right in life, they often seek a shaman because they believe that it has a supernatural cause. So that's really the only, well, there is one other way. That's the primary way it's used. They also sometimes use salvia in low doses as sort of a tea of the dried leaves. This is like not as a visionary experience, and very relatively low doses as a medicinal herb that is used to treat various conditions, including headache, rheumatism, some kind of condition that involves a swollen abdomen. They also use it to regulate some eliminatory functions, like it promotes urination. It also is used to regulate bowel movements. And I think it's also sometimes applied as a poultice to heal some kinds of wounds. It apparently helps with to reduce scar formation, probably because of the tannins in the leaf. But so it's got a few uses like that, or just basic medicinal uses. But when it's used that way, those are much lower doses and produce any kind of visionary effect.
So what is the chemistry of salvia?
Well, it's the compound responsible for producing a visionary experience is a diterpene called salvinorin A. Diterpenes are classic compounds that's made up of isoprene units, and I won't go into that too much, but it's distinct. Diterpenes are a type of terpene, basically two monoterpenes make a diterpene. There's a lot of diterpenes in nature, but salvin RNA is the only one known to produce, you know, visionary experience. There's some synthetic derivatives of salvin RNA that would also do the same thing, but in nature, salvin RNA is the only known diterpene to produce a visionary experience. So it's pretty unique in that respect. Chemistry, there's other compounds that probably have some kind of pharmacological activity. Well, that do. We know that they do. For example, the leaves contain a lot of tannins, and the tannins have some properties, like when applied externally, they can reduce some scar formation and on healing wounds. When taken internally, tannins can regulate bowel movements. They can basically treat diarrhea in some cases. And there's some other compounds that are known to have some kind of physiological properties in the plant, but nothing particularly dramatic.
Do we know what areas of the brain salvia works on?
Well, yeah, they're beginning to get some idea. We know specifically, what we do know is that it's salvin RNA is a very potent, highly selective kappa opioid receptor agonist, which basically means that it binds to a particular type of receptor that is located in the brain, but also in other parts of the body, kappa opioid receptors. But it binds to this particular receptor, and it doesn't appear to bind to any other types of receptor, opioid or otherwise. It's been tested in the lab somewhere around 55 or 60 different receptors have been tested so far. And, most of the receptors that are involved in psychoactive activity of other substances, as well as, just a whole broad range of receptors have been looked at. But so far, salvin RNA is only known to really have a strong affinity for this particular receptor, which is also kind of a special property, because a lot of other drugs, including mind-altering drugs, will bind to a whole, variety of different receptors. Like, for instance, LSD, binds primarily to, its activity is associated with, it's binding to a particular type of serotonin receptor, but it also has affinity for other receptors as well, where salvin RNA, it really has this very selective property, which is interesting. And you'll notice the word opioid in kappa opioid receptor. Kappa opioid receptors are one of three main classes of opioid receptors. There's also mu opioid receptors and delta opioid receptors. Salvin RNA doesn't bind to those. And it's an important distinction. Many of the effective pain medications that are used today, things like morphine and codeine and so forth, bind to other types of opioid receptors, these mu opioid receptors primarily, but also delta, and some of them have some affinity for kappa opioid receptors. But the pain alleviating properties of those drugs is primarily due to their activity at mu opioid receptors. And one problem with those drugs, as we all know, is that they're highly addictive. Excessively high doses leads to respiratory failure and death. And they also have unpleasant side effects. Regular use of those drugs can cause severe constipation, for example. But the main problem I think people have with them is they become highly addictive. People develop tolerance to them. They become dependent and have to keep escalating the dose if they're taking them for an extended period of time to treat chronic conditions. So pharmacologists have long been looking for other kinds of effective pain medications that don't have those undesirable properties. Well, it turns out that the drugs that activate this kappa opioid receptor, they also have useful pain alleviating properties, but they don't have the unwanted side effect of being highly addictive. In fact, they seem to have the opposite effect. They seem to make people not want to keep taking them. They tend to produce some dysphoria that drives people to not keep repeating the use of those things. So a number of drugs have been looked at in the past that are active at kappa opioid receptors, because pharmacologists have been you know, trying to develop useful drugs from them. It turns out the salvinorin A is probably the most selective and potent COPO-B receptor known until recently, where some derivatives of salvinorin A have been produced in the lab that are even more potent than salvinorin A. So that's how it works in terms of on the sort of neurological receptor level. There's been some scans done recently in baboons where they made some radio labeled salvinorin A and injected into baboons and followed the transport of the compound in the brain, not just the brain but other parts of the body as well. But they found that it primarily, I'm a little rusty on what the paper said. I think it was in the cerebellum and the visual cortex. There are a couple of areas in the brain that it seemed to predominantly target. I better not try and name them because I might be getting it wrong. So there's been some serious study about, like, well, where is it going? How quickly is it being eliminated? It turns out it goes to the brain very rapidly, which is no surprise because anyone who smokes salvia realizes that it takes effect very quickly. But also it is eliminated very quickly, which is also no surprise to anyone who's tried smoking salvia. But, you know, that study is done in animals, track these movement of the compound precisely, and shed some more light on how it's distributed and eliminated. And that is, I don't know, I think that sums up what we know about how it acts in the brain. Oh, there's one other thing I should mention. This is just some very recently published research done with nerve terminals, and they use mouse nerve terminals, but science probably is likely to be transferable to what happens in human brains. COPO-B receptors exist on different parts of different cells in the body and on neurons in the brain. One place they are present is on nerve terminals. Activating COPO-B receptors on those nerve terminals can affect the release or modulate the release of other neurotransmitters in the brain. And this recent study found that when salvinorin A binds to COPO-B receptors on these nerve terminals, it reduces dopamine secretion and serotonin secretion, but elevates noradrenaline secretion. So there's sort of these secondary kind of indirect effects. Salvinorin A is not binding to serotonin receptors or dopamine receptors, but it's because it's binding to COPO-B receptors on these nerve terminals, it affects the nerve terminal secretion of these neurotransmitters, which, you know, do bind to their own types of receptors in the brain. And that's, I don't know, that's about as much as I can know about that, yeah.
Yeah. Daniel, what is the legal status of salvia now? And can you talk about different states and countries, the different status where it's at now?
Yeah, it's there's about a dozen countries that have just outright banned possession of salvia divinorum. The penalties vary, of course, in different countries. Includes, just off the top of my head, Australia was the first country to ban salvia, Denmark, Sweden, Italy, Spain, South Korea, several others, Croatia, Lithuania. Similarly, about a dozen or so states have banned salvia. I think about a dozen have actually placed salvia in Schedule 1 in the state's list of Schedule 1 controlled substance. And then there's a few other states that have passed some kinds of regulation, less restrictive regulations, like California and Maine have laws that make it illegal to sell salvia to minors, but possession remains legal for adults. There's also a couple of states, Tennessee, Louisiana, and I think North Carolina, that have laws making it illegal to have salvia for when it's intended for human use, but they have provisions where it can be grown as an ornamental or used for scientific research. but some of them are very specific about what kinds of scientific research. I know this new law in North Carolina specifically states it has to be like university-affiliated researches.
Right.
Anyone can say they're using it for research. Yeah.
That's rather unfortunate considering how much safer it is probably than alcohol, I would think.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Well, it's certainly illogical. Well, it doesn't really make much sense, but obviously we know from what's been going on with people's attitudes about other vision-inducing substances that it's just people have this kind of extreme fear of them and really overreact.
Yeah. Don't explore your mind. That's dangerous. Don't look in there.
Yeah, I don't know where that level of fear comes from, but it's pretty powerful, and it certainly motivates a lot of lawmakers to pass, you know, severe laws against these things that threaten people with, you know, basically threaten to ruin people's lives if they're caught experimenting with them. And especially when you talk about a plant like, you know, you can make some argument that something like maybe heroin that's highly addictive and you know, a lot of people have, you know, a real hard time controlling their relationship with a drug like that. You know, you could make some argument that maybe you should have severe penalties. I don't know. I mean, in that case, I'm not sure that's true. But certainly with something like salvia, where it's not addictive, there's no evidence that it produces any obvious toxic effect on the body. The effects are very brief, and that people, you know, for the most part, handle it very well. It just doesn't really make sense to penalize people who want to use it.
Well, you know, I remember a few years ago back when you and I had first spoken, there was a case back east somewhere where this kid had basically committed suicide in his garage via asphyxiation from the car left running. And
no, it was actually he lit a campfire. Oh, he lit like a charcoal burner inside a tent in his garage. And,
oh, was that what it was? But I remember, you know, that basically months before he had done salvia, and he had basically become dissatisfied with society and with his family and things, and then they blamed the salvia that he had done months earlier for his suicide, and that was their reasoning behind Outline. It wasn't...
Yeah, that was in Delaware.
Yeah, it wasn't even directly related.
Yeah, well, it definitely wasn't directly related, at least as far as we know. We don't, you know, he's gone and we don't know exactly what was on his mind. And there's no evidence he was on salvia the day he committed suicide or had even used it within the last few weeks or anything. But we do know that he had been using it, you know, in a month or two prior to the suicide. And he had, after he died, his mother found notes he had kept in a journal where he described some of his salvia experiences, and he mentions that, you know, his insights on salvia made him realize that ordinary reality was meaningless and something along those lines, and that sort of nihilistic interpretation of ordinary reality that he seemed to, you know, that salvia somehow has some, his salvia experiences, you know, may have contributed to that attitude, or he might have had that attitude, and it's just the way he was interpreting his salvia experiences, which is actually probably the more likely explanation. But in any case, you know, I mean, I'm a parent, and I guess if I had a teenager who had committed suicide, or any, you know, one who was close to me, you know, I would probably, you know, natural tendency is to look for an explanation. And if you know that the person had been experimenting with some kind of drug that you don't really know what it is exactly and what its effects are, and you probably have, you know, unrealistic fears about what those effects are like, you know, it's not sort of understandable that they would just scapegoat salvia divinorum, but, you know, it's not really fair. There's probably a lot of other factors that were going on in his life that actually drove him to make that decision.
Well, like issues with his family that would cause him to have that sort of outlook in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's true. And also, you know, people use drugs for all kinds of different reasons, but one of the reasons a lot of people, and often young people who are teenagers and sort of struggling with all the complications of finding their identity and developing an adult personality, often people use drugs basically for escapism. They're trying to sort of escape uncomfortable feelings they're struggling with. And so, you know, in that case, the drug use is really a symptom of or their sort of escapist use of drugs is really a symptom of some, their underlying struggle with themselves rather than a cause of it. It's certainly the drug use is not causing them to have that unhappiness in life. It's, in that case, it's the unhappiness is causing them to seek escape, and often people use drugs for that kind of escape. Well, salvia is really a poor choice for that person. really, although people who haven't tried it don't know that, and I think, you know, usually people think of drugs as sort of getting them an escape from their ordinary life. And
well, they think of all drug experiences as basically like alcohol, and that anything outside of alcohol must be bad. And some, you know, but what's interesting is the escapism philosophy with most entheogens. It's sort of the opposite, because entheogens really make you face a lot of the things that you're trying to escape. So, you know, in general, it's a bad, you know, entheogens in general are a bad escape drugs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it has the opposite effect. But, you know, also this, all these entheogens do produce states where if you're not really mindful about what you're doing and you're really sort of mature about how you interpret the experience, I'm sure that a lot of people taking it for the wrong reasons or just, you know, just doing it carelessly can actually find themselves having difficulty integrating the experience and making sense of it. You know, especially someone who doesn't have much experience or no experience with a strong psychedelic substance, you know, trying to make sense of what you've just been through is with it. You know, in cultures where these things are used traditionally, you have tradition. You have a place for these things, and they're used in a ritual context, and there's ways, traditional ways that these things are understood. And you know, for example, in the Mazda text, they interpret the experience in terms of contact with, you know, sacred beings and the underworld and so forth. So they have a sort of way of categorizing the experience or making sense in terms of their worldview. But for a lot of people in the West these days, they, unless they've done some serious research beforehand or been sort of educated by someone else, they just have a very confusing experience that's totally out of unrelated to anything they've experienced before, and trying to make sense of that is probably not easy to do on your own without any, you know, guidelines.
So oh, for sure, and
I'm
especially
sure it can be confusing. Yeah.
I was just going to add, especially when our society tells you that, you know, if you have these experiences, you're going crazy or you're losing your mind or whatever, and then you have an out-of-body experience or a full-blown, or as, you know, Stan Grof creates these type 1 through type 4 of the experiences. If you have a full-blown type 4 level experience and you've never been explained these things and you don't have a support system on your return, you return to a bunch of people who are ignorant about it or poo-poo what you're trying to explain to them and things like that. It can be an issue because, you know, our society, like you're saying, our society is just not adapted to attempt to understand that. So, you know, it all goes back to setting and doing it with responsible people that understand what you're going through and are there to support you. And if you do have a full-blown experience and you think you've just gone crazy when you step into what may or may not be another dimension or whoever knows what's going on there, if it's just some chemical reaction or if it's really some quantum.
For sure, yeah.
Right.
But, you know, what people do now, understandably, is they, you know, they interpret it according to their, you know, the kind of pre-existing beliefs and so forth. And for a lot of people, I find they tend to interpret the entheogenic experiences, well, not a significant number of people who are so inclined interpret them in terms of sort of a spiritual experience. But usually those are people who are predisposed to thinking in terms of a spirit world and, you know, often have some kind of, you know, belief in an afterlife and a soul and something that's separate from the physical realm. So they experience something like this that's an sort of, you know, an experience that is separate from their ordinary physical experience of the physical world. They're, you know, having a journey to wherever, whatever they see during the experience, but it's, a narrative theme that unfolds, and they go places and meet entities and so forth, just similar to what happens during sleep dreams. But often people interpret those experiences as actual journeys to, some spiritual realm, and, these are encounters with, spirit beings and so forth. So for a lot of people, maybe it's possible that that is actually what's happening, or it may not be. It may be that that is just sort of this layer of interpretation and meaning that's laid on top of the experience because the person already kind of has.
Well, have you read Benny Shannon's book, Antipodes of the Mind?
Yeah, I haven't read it cover to cover. I have a copy, and I've read bits and pieces of it.
What did you? Well, and in fact, I was just going to ask you about that. But what do you think of, his breakdown? He sort of tries to debunk if it's hallucinogen or just, a chemical reaction, or if the experience is real. And he came to the conclusion that he couldn't prove that it was just a chemical reaction, that he had to admit that it was a real experience.
Yeah, I remember that. I don't know. I'm more of a skeptic. I think I'm actually, personally, I'm weighing in on the side of it actually being something that's happening in the brain. Even though I totally understand that when you're having these experiences, it's so convincingly real that you wouldn't question that it couldn't be an actual journey to an actual place that exists. Yeah.
How do you explain events that often happen on entheogens like telepathy and things like that? Stan Grof goes into that with his studies, and he says that he just, they had so many hundreds of telepathy reports, and they would put people under all sorts of conditions trying to, to test it out. And he said he would put people in another room, and they would be telling him what he was writing on a pad of paper from the other room and things like that.
Yeah, well, I don't know the details of his experiments with that, so it would be interesting to look that up. I would say if you found something that impressive, I mean, that is, if you can repeatedly demonstrate that people are reliably, reading people's minds in another room, or, seeing what someone's writing on a pad, I don't know why, there's not teams of people replicating that and getting all kinds of excitement going on that. Maybe there's some kind of bias that's preventing people from, but I, on that, scientists want to know if something like that exists and is going on.
Well, from my own experience, and I've obviously tried entheogens, and it doesn't happen every time. It maybe happens 5 or 10% of the time I've ever taken them, but I've probably had in the range of 45 to 50 what I would say were significant telepathic experiences with other people in and not in the same room.
Yeah, I don't know. I've had some interesting experiences too that, and I don't know. I'm not sure, what I think about it. I mean, I'm certainly not saying I'm, convinced that it's all just some kind of physical neurological phenomenon that's taking place.
I think you and I did a radio show about 2 or 3 years ago together on this exact topic, didn't we?
we might. I remember talking about it before a bit, So I don't know. I'm remaining skeptical. I think that there may be other, I think that we might, have biased interpretations of what we're experiencing. And I don't know, I guess you'd have to look at enough cases like that and really look at, what exactly was the information that you received, and really looking, is there another sort of explanation plausible? And I don't know.
Right.
It's something that just, certainly deserves further research. Because you're not the only person. Obviously, a lot of people claim to have, telepathic insights, and I see something that's, for example, I can give you lots of examples, but just one popped in my head is when Gordon Wasson was investigating the Mazdak use of psilocybin mushrooms. He consulted, I think it was Marie Sabina at one point, and asked about the welfare of his his daughter was having a baby.
And
you know,
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, I think she said, you know, she's fine and well and so forth. And of course she was, but, you know, chances were pretty high that she was fine and well anyway.
You know, there was another story, actually, that his son had gotten into trouble and there were some things that had happened. And then when he had gotten home and talked to his son, the events actually happened exactly how she had described. So there was another, there was a couple of the experiences, but I don't remember, you know, I've read the story a number of times, but he talks about how he was just blown away by the accuracy of Sabina's description. But
Yeah, so, it's interesting, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of remaining sort of agnostic on the subject, although an awful lot of things tend to make me sort of favor sort of this lightly. Anyway, I've really shifted. I used to be more in terms of a believer, but I've become more of a materialist, I guess. But
yeah.
Anyway,
I guess I've gone back and forth over the years, but you know, there's some of the larger ones that I've had that just, there were some things and people in the room, and we sat and talked about it afterward, and we eliminated possibilities, and that was pretty much all that was left, you know.
Yeah.
Let me.
Yeah, one other thing before we go on is that, you know, has been for me one. Well, I mean, that's pretty good evidence if you have a lot of convincing stories. Like, I mean, there's going to be sort of accidental, sort of coincidental, correct sort of experiences like that sometimes where people, you know, are thinking about a person or whatever, and you know, they have some thought, and you know, there's going to be some cases where that just is going to be chance that they're correct about something. I guess it depends on how specific it is. But the other point I wanted to make that is a convincer for a lot of people it's very persuasive for me, is often on these experiences, people are transported to realms that seem to have no relationship to anything they've experienced before. They, you know, see, you know, beings that, you know, are not made out of ordinary stuff. They're, you know, some kind of energetic stuff that they've never encountered anything, you know, like that in their ordinary lives. So, you know, where does something like that come from, and why do a lot of people, you know, describe similar things?
And they'll say, well, you know, I know what's in the recesses of my own mind, and that wasn't there before.
Yeah, exactly. You know, with dreams, it's mostly stuff that, you know, does seem to be derived from remembered experiences and stuff that is part of your experience, is stored information. But often with psychedelic experiences, certainly a high dose or high level psychedelic experiences, people, you know, experience things that just are so otherworldly that it's hard to, that it doesn't really add up. But I don't know, you know, maybe that's just what the brain pieces together, some model of reality in a totally different way when it's, you know, exposed to these compounds, and it might still be a brain thing. It's the brain is piecing together a seemingly solid, physical, convincingly real version of what we ordinarily consider real based on just sensory information, putting all that together and making everything like this really convincing, real seeming thing. But of course, you know, we're experiencing it all in our heads. The brain is very good at modeling of convincing reality. It may be these drugs, you know, when it's sort of cut, interpreting information in a different way, it may just be modeling it, you know, in just as a convincingly way, but it's modeling it in a very different fashion.
And then
it seems quite different, but it still seems quite real.
Right. And then you have these new scientific reports coming out of them sending information or light waves through a split atom particle or whatever, hundreds of miles apart, you know, and instantaneously it arrives there, and, you know, and then it's like, well, and then there's that aspect too, and you have to consider all these different levels of quantum mechanics, and it's definitely beyond our grasp, beyond anything other than, I suppose, speculation at this
point. Well, that's pretty interesting stuff, although, you know, it seems that those kind of quantum effects only take place on a subatomic level. That's not how, you know, organized, you know, bodies of atoms behave. So, you know, whether, I'm not sure it's really very, you know, it's sort of convenient to use something like that as evidence, like, well, maybe, you know, things can, you know, transport between one dimension and another or something, but I don't know, you know, just because it's a atomic particle has those properties doesn't mean like a human being has those properties. But who knows, maybe right. The mind does, and I don't know. I think it's going to be a very long time before we really have some actual true understanding of how these things work and what these experiences truly represent.
So, you know, let's go into the discussion of the experience here briefly. Can you describe the salvia experience?
I can describe it for myself. I can describe it, you know, some general categories that are common for a lot of people. I mean, I've reviewed probably 2,000 or 3,000 people's salvia experiences over the years, mostly doing research for my book, but also just, you know, because people email me experiential reports frequently. It's one effect that is very common is, I don't know how I should start here. I'll start by just saying there's a few categories that a lot of people experience. These aren't things that, it's not everybody experiences the same things, but some of these things are things that, you know, different groups of people commonly report. For example, traveling back into early childhood is something that happens with a lot of people on salvia, and that's something that I often experience. And typically this is a period when people are 6 or 7 years old, right around that period of life. During the experience, they suddenly find themselves transported to, or they're having a vision often it feels as if you're actually transported to the place, but it's a place that's familiar to you from childhood. And often people say that it's not just that they're seeing a scene like, you know, maybe the school playground or their parents' backyard or whatever, or their bedroom or whatnot. It's not just that they're seeing a scene that's familiar from that time in their life, but they actually feel the way that they felt when they were a child that age during the experience. While they're seeing this, it's almost like they've been sort of transported back to this place and time where they, you know, it's not just like remembering what something looked like. It's they feel like they've just stepped back in time. And it's curious that it's almost always that period in life. I never hear people saying, well, I went back to high school or I went back to, you know, some other period. It's almost always when people have these childhood regression experiences, it's always that particular period. So I think that's something really interesting is, well, why is it so often generating that particular type of vision? What is it about that period in life that salvia is tapping into? And, you know, it suggests that could be utilized for psychotherapeutic value, that you could deliberately use salvia as a tool for accessing, experiences in early life that might be need to be reexamined. So that's one thing that a lot of people experience. A lot of people never have that type of experience. Another one that's very common is feeling like you've become an object. This is something that I don't think has ever happened to me, but an awful lot of people experience it with salvia. They, you know, during the experience, they suddenly think they've become whatever. they become a floor. They become a piece of furniture. you know, one person said they became a kitchen blender. and sometimes very odd things like a surface. Like a couple of people have told me that they became paint on a wall. Very odd things, but, you know, they're usually when people describe this kind of thing, they're, you know, they really emphasize the fact that it wasn't just like they felt as if they were that thing. They say they were that thing. So it's a very convincing kind of experience. They just feel like they've become either trapped in an object or they've just become the object. Sometimes it's or some intermediate thing where they feel like they kind of merged with an object.
almost like the stories of lycanthropy and morphing into animals that you hear with peyote and mushrooms and ayahuasca and things, but instead
more
instead,
mundane things. Well,
yeah.
Sometimes people do become other people, or animals. I've heard a lot of people have experiences like that. But often it is just like these strangely mundane things, and it's sort of like, well, why that? You know, sometimes it's something that's actually in the environment that they're in, so that sort of makes some sense that might happen. Some of the brain is sort of interpreting perceptions in a weird way, and identifying with them. But often it's things that aren't in the environment. So who knows what's going on with that? Another very common experience with salvia is perceptions of two-dimensionality, where the room they're in just flattens out into this two-dimensional surface, or they're having visions of strange membranes and flat two-dimensional things that are warping in different ways, and two-dimensionality in different forms is very common. Oh, another one that's very, very common with salvia is some sense of motion that's not actually occurring. That's motion that's not actual physical motion, where people feel that they're, moving in some way that their body isn't actually doing. Often it's twisting.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't know. Well, my guess is that it's salvinorinase, activating GABAopioid receptors in some parts of the brain that are associated with interpreting motion, and interpreting
balance.
Actual physical motion and possibly balance, and somehow it's affecting those perceptions and sort of generating these kind of hallucinations that are motion hallucinations. So that's my guess. I don't know what else. Maybe there's some other explanation. But it's very common, and actually most people who take salvia describe something along those lines. Sometimes it's just a sensation of becoming weightless and sort of floating, or becoming heavy and sinking, or falling back or drifting. It's often feels almost like I'm afloat on a raft in a river or something. You sense like you're drifting along, even though you're sitting completely still. Sometimes it has interesting twists on it, where people feel like the motion seems to be separating their sort of spirit from their body. They feel like they're being pulled out of their body. And also sometimes the visions seem to involve motion too. A lot of people see visions of all kinds of things, but often turning objects are very common. For some reason, I've received a lot of reports of people seeing giant wheels, Ferris wheel-like objects, sometimes made out of beings, like a giant wheel made out of beings, and these big wheels are like turning. So there seems to be some connection. Possibly the sort of interpretation of that sensation of motion manifests as a vision of some kind. But that's another example. It's like I'm puzzled as to why I have received so many reports from people who've seen these giant Ferris wheel-like wheels. It's like, why would that be a common kind of vision? Why would salvia generate something that specific in a lot of people? And often people say it's made out of beings. This makes it even weirder. So I don't know. I have no explanation for that. If it's just a drug effect, why would it activate the brain in some way that would produce that kind of vision?
And in fact, repeatedly in other people as well.
Exactly. But then on the other hand, if they're actually traveling to some place else, it's pretty weird. I mean, that seems pretty odd that there'd be some kind of giant wheel made out of beings.
You know what?
All
of my big experiences, no matter what entheogen it was, I would classify as in large part weird. So
well, that's the best word for it, I think. Yeah, weird.
Well, let me ask you, what's the most bizarre experience you've heard from somebody who's taken salvia?
Boy, I don't know. Bizarre. Well, so many bizarre ones. I don't even know where to start. I have to think about that a bit. Maybe something will pop in my head. But in the meantime, I'm thinking of bizarre ones. I know one that I often think about. I remember someone wrote me an account of an experience he had several years ago where he, I don't know, I think it definitely qualifies as bizarre. He smoked salvia. I think he was sitting in his bedroom or office or something on a chair, and suddenly he was transported to the garden of a monastery, I think it was. And he had just become a monk working in the garden of the monastery. He had no memory of being a person sitting in a chair smoking salvia, he just was that person. And to him at the time, it was just as if that's the way his life had always been. And he was quite content, and he remembered all this and talked about when he came back. But and then at some point, it's been a while since I read this report, so I might be a little fuzzy on the details, but it doesn't really matter. At some point, I think he heard, some chiming of the monastery church bells. It was all extremely real, and it's like he just stepped into an alternate existence. And at some point, he just suddenly found himself being pulled out of it and confused and didn't know what was happening. Somehow, he suddenly just found himself sitting in this chair, and it took him a while to make sense of it. And then he remembered that he'd smoked the salvia and this kind of thing. There's lots of experiences similar to that. That one impressed me because he was he went into so much detail. He described the clouds in the sky and he saw it so... it seemed so real to him, and it seemed so strange that he even mentioned that, while he was in that state, he had the memories of the person who he had become. It's like this life was not just, sort of an impression of another person. It was so detailed that he, had a whole set of memories associated with that person.
Wow.
So that's kind of interesting, but that's not, particularly unusual. A lot of people have that kind of experience. Go ahead.
I was just going to mention a few years ago, a buddy of mine down in Huntington Beach mentioned a trip that he had taken with salvia where he had smoked it and then had this experience. Well, it was actually two experiences, so let me clarify that. But he smokes the salvia. Has this experience where he's at somebody's house a week or two in the future, and all of a sudden he ends up at this person's house and he's sitting there smoking salvia.
Right.
And so a week or 2 weeks later, he's at this place, and then suddenly they end up smoking salvia.
Right.
And he ends up going back to the first trip, where he sees himself going forward to the second one smoking it. So,
that's complicated.
and he was, he's like, oh, he calls me. I got to tell you about this.
that's a pretty good one. Yeah. I've heard several reports from people saying that they had premonition experiences where during the experience, they saw something happen clearly. And then it actually happened later. And not exactly the same as what you're saying, but yours is a little more convoluted. But that's interesting. But a lot of salvia experiences are very bizarre, and they make for sort of interesting stories. But often people, say, well, they sometimes people will say, well, they felt like they got a lot out of it, and they somehow felt like it kind of cleared mental cobwebs out of their attic, or something like that, or they just feel kind of more at ease afterwards, more sense of well-being or so forth. But some people have experiences with salvia where it really makes a major positive impact in their lives. Some people, I've actually received, lots of reports, maybe, around 30 or so, from people who have said that they were suffering from severe depression, medications weren't working for them. A few cases where people said it was so severe that they were contemplating suicide. And these people report that, after taking salvia, it totally alleviated their depression and turned their life around in some cases. I mean, this one guy, I always remember he was suicidal, and, he had a partner who had died, and he just became extremely depressed and was thinking of just ending it all. Somehow he stumbled on salvia, and not expecting this kind of thing to happen, but somehow it totally gave him a fresh perspective on life and made him value it in a whole new way. That's the kind of thing that interests me particularly, is when people actually get a lot of benefit from the experience, and clearly it can be very beneficial, and if it's used, especially if it's used, in a mindful way with appropriate preparations and so forth.
All right, Daniel. So talk about the positive and negative effects of salvia.
Uh-oh, I think I just sort of answered part of your question.
Well,
well, that's the antidepressant effect is one, as I just mentioned.
That actually almost falls more under a medical thing, since they call it Schedule 1. It's obviously got medical application, right?
No, it's not supposed to.
Right.
Well, let's see. Well, it does fall sort of under a medical category. Well, that's a beneficial effect. What I find useful about it is it's a tremendously powerful tool for delving into the inner psyche, into basically doing self exploration, and it can be used as a tool for doing meaningful self-exploration. There's been many times in my life, not just this kind of applies to a lot of psychedelic substances, but for me, salvia's been particularly valuable, is that these things are great tools for going into the inner psyche and finding out things about oneself that one ordinarily isn't seeing. Sometimes there's things that, should be obvious to ourselves, like solutions to relationship problems or, really understanding how we really feel about things. Often our conscious minds are just ignoring things, or they're just, blind to things that are, maybe should be right in front of us. Sometimes they're just deep, deep things that are hard to gain insight about. But salvia and some of these other related things often just puts you in a place where you go into your inner self and the answer is just right in front of you, and you wonder, how come I just didn't see that before? I don't know if I'm making myself that clear with what I'm trying to describe, but I know that that's something that's been very valuable to me, particularly, I can think of cases in relationships where I just was, struggling with issues and frustrated and just wasn't really seeing what I needed to do about a situation. I have a good example for you. My wife and I met at the Planck conference about 8 years ago now. And we had a salvia experience together. And this is after we'd only known each other for, a few days. And, I had been a person who was really, afraid of commitment, I guess you could say, in my relationships.
Afraid of what?
Oh, commitment. I would say. My relationships in the past. I'm always, the idea of actually marrying somebody was just, even though I'd been in long-term relationships, a 16-year relationship and so forth, living together was fine, but the idea of actually the idea of marriage just scared me to death. And so here's this person who, I met and hardly knew, and I certainly wasn't looking for anyone to get very seriously involved with at that point. But we took salvia together, and I had a vision of bridal veils. It's just like my our field of vision was like swarming with these bridal veils. And it just made me realize that I actually was really attracted to this person and I realized that there was, that I had these very deep feelings and that I actually, we ended up marrying the next year. So that was kind of an interesting thing, but it's the kind of thing, it's like, I wasn't actually seeing it consciously, but during the experience, it made me, really, maybe I, eventually would have, come around to realizing my feelings about her, but it put it right in my face. Even I think, part of my mind on a conscious level was actively avoiding that kind of line of thinking. So I wasn't actually facing my feelings, and there's been lots of experiences like that in my life with various psychedelics. It's great tools for getting in touch with your inner feelings and getting clarity about what's important to you in life.
Your own psychotherapy.
Yeah, exactly.
So, what is the single most important thing you would like people to understand about salvia, and for that matter, take away from this interview?
That's going to narrow it down. Well, I don't know. There's so many things I want to say. The single most, I think, is that it should be used in a mindful, respectful manner, and that people should be very aware that it's important, like all drugs, it's important to use appropriate doses. Unfortunately, people, a lot of the salvia products that are being marketed today are excessively potent extracts that have no dosage information on the packages and no guidelines for how to use the right amount to produce this manageable, productive experience. So I think that most people using salvia today are actually taking excessively high doses and understandably having very disorientating, confusing, unpleasant experiences because they're just taking excessively high doses. And why people are marketing these really excessively potent extracts is presumably because just business is, you know, first there was a 5 times potent extract,
right.
Then some other vendors that thought they could corner more of the market if they sold it 10 times. And there was this kind of escalation in potency. And I don't, obviously a lot of these people just don't really care what effect it has on people. They just want to sell it. I don't know, that really bothers me a lot, but in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of people posting videos of themselves or their friends on salvia on YouTube. And the vast majority of those clearly, you know, show people not only taking salvia in a really careless, kind of mindless, reckless way, but they, just by seeing the behavior, it's clear that they're taking excessively high doses. And it's not surprising given what's being marketed these days. So that really bothers me. So I really think it's really important for people to be aware that there's a problem with that and that people are too, you know, stronger is not better with any drug. It's, you know, there is, you know, a useful dose and there's a dose that's producing problems.
What's the highest level of extract you recommend? Sorry for interrupting you there.
Yeah, no, well, that's... well, if a person has an analytical balance, they can, you know, pure salvinorin A can be used quite safely if you have an analytical balance and you can weigh, you know, a milligram or less accurately. You know exactly how much you're getting. But most people don't, and most of the products don't say exactly how much salvinorin A is in the product. So even if you did have a precise balance, you wouldn't really know how much to weigh. A lot of the majority of products will say something like 5x or 50x or 80x or whatever, which basically means that the product is supposedly that many times more potent than the leaf material from which it was made. But salvia leaves vary a lot in potency to begin with, so some, you know, 5 times one batch of leaves is not the same as 5 times another batch of leaves. Some leaves can vary, you know, quite a bit sometimes. Well, they range from, you know, the weakest ones being like maybe 0.5 milligram of salvinorin A per gram, and the stronger ones being 4 or 5 milligrams. So, you know, multiple times levels of potency in the leaves to begin with. So those numbers, they only tell you how many times more potent it is than the starting material. So that's not a precise dosage to begin with. Also, a lot of these products are clearly exaggerating the potency. Things that say 60x or 80x are not 68 or 80x. It just doesn't make sense. It would be like a pure white crystalline material if you're getting into that strength, and they're not those things. So obviously a lot of manufacturers are exaggerating the claims, just thinking that it's going to sell the product better. There's also some confusing labeling going on where people will say 40x or something like that, and it's not actually 40 times the potency. It's actually what they're saying, that it's actually 40. It has 40 milligrams of salvinorin A per gram of leaf, and so they're just sort of using that 40x nomenclature in a different way, and that is very, you know, totally confusing, because actually if you translated 40 milligrams per gram, it would probably be more in the neighborhood of, you know, 20x or something like that. So there's a big problem with all the packaging and the marketing that's going on. The strongest, you know, if you're talking in accurate dosage measurement, I think the strongest thing that I would recommend people use, if they don't have a way to precisely measure the dose, is about six times the average leaf potency, which works out to about 15 milligrams per gram of leaf.
Yeah, you used to be able to get 7X, and I always thought that 7X was about perfect for my personal use.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets much stronger than that, and then it starts... Well, because at that concentration, it, you know, it makes it easier to smoke than the plain leaf, so you don't have to inhale so much smoke. But it's still... It's a certain measure of safety, because you can only inhale so much smoke in one lungful. So you can't... It makes it... It's not too strong. You don't. You won't accidentally take an excessively strong dose with one lungful. So the amount you can inhale, you know, provides some... safety. And then, you know, if you, based on the effect you get from the first lungful, if you, you know, you can take a second one if you judge you want a stronger effect. But when it starts getting stronger than that, you can easily take two, especially when you get these really strong potencies like 20, 30, 40, whatever. You can very easily take, you know, doses two or three times stronger or more than what is really manageable in one lungful. And I think that based on what I'm seeing fold these days, and the, you know, behavior of people I see on these YouTube videos, I think that's what's happening, is people are taking, you know, really excessively high doses, and, you know, they, I don't know, I don't understand this whole YouTube phenomenon, why people would want to, you know, really take a high dose of a drug and stumble around acting foolish and put it on the internet. Is, I don't know, sir, I guess it's that, jackass phenomenon.
Right, exactly. And it's like the level of ignorance when you put it in context with the Mazatex where it's originated. It's just beyond
it's
absurd.
Awful.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you would like to add to the discussion?
No, you know, be safe and be conscientious about doing things. Be, you know, mindful and aware of why you, you know, engage with these kinds of experiences and substances, and, you know, stay safe. And I, one thing I do want to mention is that, we didn't touch upon this, so let me say something about it. You know, there's a lot of important pharmaceutical research going on with salvinorin and derivatives, compounds, you know, derived from salvinRNA. It's actually, there's a lot of excitement and amongst various pharmacologists, and that they think that salvinRNA could lead to some truly useful medical compounds, and you know, that's certainly unrelated to its traditional use and so forth, or why most of us use salvia. But I think it's an important point to mention is that there really are strong indications that very valuable medications, particularly like non-addictive pain medications and so forth, can be developed from salvinRNA derivatives. So that's something that is important to point out, especially when people are talking about putting a substance in Schedule 1 really severely hampers research, and that, you know, is a kind of a crime to, you know, stop research on something that can be useful for people's well-being. Yeah.
So, Daniel, you've got a new book coming out here sometime soon, and do you want to talk about that real quick?
Oh, I have a book, you know, tentatively titled Divine Sage. I started writing this thing about 11 or 12 years ago. And at the time I started writing it, very little was known about salvinRNA. It wasn't known how it acted in the brain. There was like hardly any scientific research on it. Very little was known about the plant. A lot of what people thought they knew about the plant turned out to be inaccurate. So when I first conceived of it, you know, it's going to be a slim volume, sort of just, you know, with guidelines on how to use it in a safe, responsible way and how to grow the plant and so forth. But, you know, there's been lots of delays and interruptions in my life that have caught me to put it on the back burner for periods of time. And during those periods, a lot's changed in the world of salvia, and it's gotten a lot, it's been, you know, used by a lot more people. It's much more widely available. There's these legal issues that are changing in the world around salvia. There's all this research that's been, you know, in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been something like 120 papers published in peer-reviewed scientific journals describing scientific research on salvia. And so I've had to incorporate, well, I haven't had to, but I've chosen to incorporate all this stuff into the book, and it's grown to this big thing that's, you know, around 550 pages or so now. So I'm trying to get the thing done, and it is almost done. It's very close to being ready for publication, and hopefully I can find time to finish it off and get it out there in the near future.
Well, it sounds
next year.
It sounds like it's going to be the primary work to have, or the definitive work to have on Salvia. And from what I
well,
know,
hopefully nobody else is crazy enough to spend so much time writing a book about Salvia as I have.
Well, you know, it needed to be done because there's a big gaping hole and a lot of misinformation out there, and we need a good thick 500-600 page book on Salvia. And
I'm proud of it, and I do want to get it out there because it's got a lot of useful information. It pieces together a lot of information from different sources in a concise way, and I feel like, you know, it's a responsibility for getting it out there so people can have access to it. I've been maintaining my website for many years, which is, you know, it's just conceived as an educational resource, but because I've been writing the book, you know, I try to keep, you know, a lot of useful information on the website, but because I've been writing the book, I haven't wanted to put everything on the website because there's not much
right.
point writing the book. So the website's been seems like very select amount of information, and I look forward to getting the book out into the world.
All right. So speaking of your website, please give out your web address and any contact information or anything you would like to give people.
Well, the web address is sagewisdom.org. And, there's links there to contact me by email if someone wants to do that. I encourage people to go there for more information. There's some basic user's guide. There's like a Salvia Divinorum user's guide there and a Salvia Divinorum FAQ. And those two documents particularly people should read because they provide, you know, all the basic information about Salvia and what it is and how it can be used in a productive manner.
Great. And thank you, Daniel, for your time. And this concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 43. And keep me posted when your book comes out. Maybe we can do another show, or I'd love to read that thing and review it or whatever.
Yeah, I'll definitely do that.
All right.
Show my list. I'll stay in touch.
All right, Daniel. Likewise. Yeah. And thanks again for coming on the show.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.